Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, November 5th, 2018. This is the top of the pile. Now, before I start talking about the books, I want to do a little announcement in terms of schedule for the podcast. I want to get these out on kind of a consistent basis every week. So instead of doing the sometimes three times, sometimes four, sometimes five, we're going to stick to just three times a week. And the schedule's going to be going forward Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then off until the following Monday. So every other day there'll be a new episode except for the end of the second week, in which there'll be a three-day period. That'll give me enough time to get the episodes together, do exactly what I want, get these out on a regular basis, and then I can kind of fit everything into my schedule. So that's going to be it. Let's talk about the books. And there's a few books. Of course, last week was Halloween. I hope everyone had a good Halloween, by the way. I had a great Halloween. Halloween is my favorite holiday of the year. I didn't dress up, but I read a ton of horror books, as you could tell by all the horror episodes that I put out last week. So, of course, because it was Halloween, and because Halloween was a Wednesday, and Wednesday is New Comic Book Day, there were a ton of publishers putting out horror-related material. And so, of course, on this episode, there will be a few horror books that I'll be talking about, but there will also be some non-horror stories. So I want to kick off with one that is not a horror book. It is a Marvel book. And of course, if you know my preference for comic book characters, you will know that my favorite X-Men character is Emma Frost. So to kick things off, I want to talk about X-Men Black Emma Frost number one. Is there a number? I think there's a number. It's a standalone issue. All these X-Men Black issues are standalone. It is written by Lee Williams with art by Chris Bucalo. We've got like six different inkers. We've got like seven different colorists. Letters by Corey Pettit. And a gorgeous cover. Gorgeous cover by Jessica Campbell and Sabine Rich. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this book is when I first read this issue, I hated it. Now, that quickly changed. But the way the book kicks off, I just didn't get it. The art style, I wasn't a fan of it too much. I think it did get much better as the story progressed, but I didn't care for the beginning of this issue. The costume that was picked for Emma Frost is not really my favorite of the costumes that she's had, but I understood kind of what they were trying to do once the story actually kicked into gear. So basically, Emma Frost talks to Rogue and the X-Men because she's got a plan to take over, or not to take over, to destroy the Hellfire Club, because the Hellfire Club is regaining power. At the helm is, of course, Sebastian Shaw, the Black King, and she, you know, she's kind of played the good guy for a little while with the X-Men. Now, she had a relationship with Cyclops for a while, rest in peace. Is the other one dead too now? I'm not talking about extermination today, but I'm pretty sure young Cyclops got killed too. Anyways, poor Cyclops can't catch a break. That should be the episode title, but it's not going to be. So she wants to meet up with the X-Men to talk about this plan to kind of take down the Hellfire Club before they become really powerful again, because they've had some issues and there's been some power shifting, power balance shifting, and the Hellfire Club is building new cells around the world, and Emma sees this and wants the X-Men to intervene before they get too powerful, because of course the Hellfire Club is a large arch nemesis of the X-Men and have been for a long time. Now, I had a little bit of an issue with this because the way that Emma was coming off didn't really seem like Emma. But once I started continuing the issue and saw what the master plan was, then I understood exactly why Emma was doing this. And I gotta say, it was typical Emma Frost. Because she kind of plays the victim in the beginning, right? And that's something that Emma's really good at. Emma is very duplicitous, and that's one reason that I really enjoy the character. But it does take a really great writer, I think, to bring that out in the character. And I think Lee Williams did a fantastic job here with Emma Frost. So basically, Rogue and the X-Men agree to meet with her, but they don't want to do it in the mansion because they don't really trust Emma, with good reason. They shouldn't really trust her. But they agree to meet her, but where will they meet her? None other than Walmart. Well, it's Marmart in this issue, but you know, it's Walmart. And I do wonder if that's maybe, I don't know if it was a choice made because Walmart is just a place with tons of people. So there can't really be any fishy business going on because, you know, they're out in public. But at the same time, this is Emma Frost. And, I mean, everyone knows who the X-Men are. So I'm not sure really why that would make any difference. There's a couple jokes in there that I didn't want in an Emma Frost book, but, you know, I thought they were pretty good. You know, the Walmart thing being one of them. The other one, having Rogue choose Walmart because it's a place where, they'll just kind of fit in because, you know, there's that website, People at Walmart, where people just wear whatever the F they want. You see people with, anyways, go to peoplewalmart.com. You'll see what I'm talking about. So they meet there and Emma's like, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. She goes through this whole thing and tells Rogue the plan. Now, this is when things really get great because I think there's a fantastic sequence of panels, following the meeting at Walmart. And it really shows just how great a character Emma Frost is. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, go pick this book up. Kind of deal with the first couple of pages, right, where we're getting the whole thing set up. But once you see Emma going into this building and she's going after Shaw and in all the process that she goes through, because of course she's got these psychic abilities and just the way she treats people was just awesome, awesome, like perfect Emma Frost, right? So like she's going through and she sees bodyguards and she's just like window and they just like jump out the window. And, just like stuff like that. And I really loved it because that's the kind of character that Emma is, right? She doesn't let anything get in the way of herself achieving the goal that she wants to achieve. And as we learn, the goal that she wants to achieve is to take over the Hellfire Club. Over the Hellfire Club. And it's cool the way she does this. She goes into, finally this bunker that Shaw is hauled up in and he beats the crap out of her. But of course, she's got like her diamond skin, so she's unscathed. And there's a couple of puns in there about how she can't be scratched. And she ends up actually tricking Shaw because he was supposedly sleeping with this girl right before she came in. And the girl actually was working with Emma Frost. Now, I don't know if they said explicitly that it was an X-Men character. My assumption is that maybe it is. But yeah, she puts this poison in Shaw's tea and Shaw is helpless. So now Emma Frost becomes the Black King, and of course she's wearing the black costume again. So I thought that was really cool. I prefer the white over the black, but I'll take Emma any way I can. And I like the mischievousness of the character, how well it was represented in this issue. I really enjoyed it. I think all these X-Men Black books have been really good. In particular, Magneto in this one, I think they really got the characters really nailed down. And of course, I love Emma. So if you're a fan of Emma Frost, if you want to see just what a conniving B-word she is, then this is the book for you. For me, it's going to be a 4 out of 5. On over to Ahoy Comics, a publisher that I've been talking about a lot lately because I think they do some really fantastic work. Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Terror, issue number 1. There's a bunch of creators on this. We got a few stories. The first one is The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar, written by Tom Payer with art by Fred Harper, colors by Michael Garland, and letters by Rob Steen. We have Dark Chocolate, written by the amazingly talented Mark Russell. That's the story I'm going to be talking about here, by the way, with art by Peter Snebjerg. I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Peter. I apologize. Letters by Rob Steen. We've got a story by Sienna Madrid with art by Carly Wright, The Scallop and the Barnacle. There's another piece, The Black Cat by Hunt Emerson, and then a Q&A with Mark Russell at the end. And this book is really interesting. It definitely harkens back to stuff like, you know, Tales from the Crypt and those kind of books where you have like a storyteller, a character that sets up the story, and then you jump right in to a tale and you have a little, you know, the character pops in at the end and kind of gives you the moral of the story or whatever. If you enjoy that kind of thing, this is right up your alley. And of course, Ahoy does a great job with the comedy as well. And, you know, comedy and horror work very well together. I've said this many times, so if you've heard this, then I apologize. But comedy and horror are very similar because the way to set the stories up are exactly the same. The key to both comedy and horror is timing. And I gotta say, this book nails the timing. It is perfect. Perfect. I enjoyed the first story by Tom Payer. It's kind of an Edgar Allan Poe story, so, you know, Poe definitely makes sense to be the storyteller for this book. Of course, I like the comedy in the beginning, by the way, when they introduce Edgar Allan Poe. He explicitly states that, like, the reason that they pick Poe is because, you know, nobody can sue them for a likeness or whatever. I thought that was pretty interesting. And of course, I'm a huge Edgar Allan Poe fan, so it was cool to see. As soon as this book was announced, not knowing anything about it, just based on the title, I knew I was going to put this on my pull list, and I'm glad I did. I do want to talk about the Mark Russell story, because I think that is the best thing in this book. It is one of the most creative horror stories that I've seen in quite a long time, in any form of media. And the reason for that is that it basically takes kids' serials and tells a horror story about it. And how it does that is by turning serial cartoon characters into actual people. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about like the Count Chocula serial and the Captain Crunch serial and like the Bowberries thing. You know what I'm talking about? Like those kind of serials. All those cartoony serial things are actual characters in this book. And that's something that Mark Russell does really great. Really great. So he's perfect for the story. That's why he's done so well with books like The Flintstones and the Porky Pig Lex Luthor one shot from a few months ago. Just absolutely brilliant how he can take such like mundane pieces of reality and turn them into really imaginative and creative stories. And basically Count Chocula, he's a vampire. This is a story about vampires. And he gathers some noble people from the land to breakfast, and this breakfast is just pancakes and cereal, right? So that's why it's partially funny because of that, because they're eating like the cereals they represent, right? So there's like Count Chocula boxes on the table or whatever. Anyways, this is morning, and of course vampires don't do well with sunlight, as you may or may not know. I'm sure everybody knows that. And so Count Chocula's kind of sitting at the end of the table. All the nobles are there eating cereal and pancakes. They're chatting with each other. One of the nobles kind of knows that this count is a vampire, and he's the one that instilled the policy in this kingdom that vampires should be killed. And so he proposes to the count's wife, "Hey, I know your husband's a vampire. If you leave him and you come be my wife, then I'll let him live. I won't tell anybody." And she doesn't want to do it, of course, because she loves her husband. She is human, by the way, but she loves her husband. And so finally, you know, everybody leaves, and the sun's getting closer and closer to the count. Finally, it's on him, and this guy's like, "Hey, I haven't eaten yet. I'm going to sit here and eat cereal next to you." So he sits down, and Count Chocula's kind of just like smoking, right, from the sun and holding all his pain in. And finally, the wife writes on a note, like, I'll do it. And gives him the napkin, and the guy's like, "Okay, I guess I'm done eating cereal. I'm going to leave now." And so he assumes that she's going to run away with him. So they kind of find a time to meet, and she tells the vampire that. She's like, "You know, you need to go rest. You've been in the sun. You know, it's not good for you. You could have died." And he's like, "I don't know what to do." And the count has a plan. And the plan is, even though he didn't want to do this because he loved his wife and he knows the horrors of being a vampire, he turns his wife into a vampire. And as a result, when she goes to meet with this guy, instead of actually running away with him, she ends up eating him and sucking out his blood. And then, you know, she goes back and joins back with her husband, and they live happily forever after. So I thought that was cool. There's a lot of romance here, a lot of horror elements, definitely a ton of comedy, but it all worked really well together. And I think that's one thing that makes Mark Russell such a great writer. So if you're not reading anything that Mark Russell does, then do yourself a favor. Go check his catalog. You can probably do like comicdb.com or whatever. Whatever the website is that gives you all the creators and all the stuff that they've done. Go check his work out. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And this may be among my favorite stories that he's done. And it's very short. It's probably like 6 or 7 pages. But highly, highly recommend not only this story, but the book itself. I look forward to the next one. This one's going to be a 5 out of 5. On over to Boom. Let's talk about Bone Parish, number 4. This is Cullen Bunn, Jonas Scharf, and Alex Guimaraes. And I've talked about Bone Parish a couple of times. I don't think I talked about issue 3, but I definitely talked about 1 and maybe 2 on the podcast. But I think this book is just really, really great. It's definitely a horror setting for this title, but it's about much more than that. It's a story about crime and crime organizations and love lost, how people react to losing loved ones. And it's a family drama as well. And I hate family dramas, but it works in the setting. And just to recap, if you never picked up this book, it follows the Winters family. They are a family of drug dealers. Originally, the drug empire was built by the father of the family, who we find out very early on that he died. And the drug that they have is not just a typical drug. It's made from the ashes of dead people. And it allows people to relive whatever ash they consume. It allows them to relive those people's lives, even just for a few moments. And for the first couple issues, I think the way that that was done was pretty standard, right? Mostly to assume or relive memories of other people. And that's generally what we see, right? Like people trying to be rock stars, they'll snort some ash from a guitar player or whatever. But in this issue, I think it really kicked it up a few notches, because there were a couple things that we see that I hadn't seen before, and I hadn't even thought about the uses for the ash. So for example, at one point, the Winters family sends out these killers to kill a drug campaign that kind of wants to take over the distribution of ash from the Winters family. And there's a reason for that, right? So the dad's dead. The mom is really in charge of the whole operation right now, but she hasn't really learned how to be a vicious criminal, right? Even though she sees the dad through inhaling his ashes, her dead husband, she doesn't really know how to do it, right? She's not a criminal. She's just kind of continuing in his legacy. And, but anyway, so she sends these killers out to get this drug kingpin, and they inhaled ash from the hashishi. And I thought that was so awesome, right? For several reasons, right? So if you don't know what the hashishi are, they were assassins in like medieval Muslim times. That's where we get the term hashish, right? It's kind of like weed, marijuana, right? Except it gives you a different feeling. It's a different plant. And that's also where we get the word assassins from. And it's, of course, these guys inhale the ash of some assassins. And there's some really cool panels where you see the assassins in the Middle Ages climbing up this castle to commit a murder as these guys are entering into the stronghold of this drug kingpin. And then as they're killing some of the bodyguards, you see them kind of hallucinate as if they are themselves hashishi and like killing a guy, right? So they're like in typical, it looks like traditional Muslim garb, but almost ninja-esque, right? So they like cover their faces and stuff like that. Really awesome. I love the way that was done. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Of course, there's a whole lot of other stuff going on here. You know, one of the sons was killed in a previous issue. And so they're trying to figure out who did it, why they did it. And they do find out. One of the crooked cops, tells them that, hey, it was this guy. Let's set him up. You can bring him in. And so they do, and they're going to collect his ashes, because I thought this was a really fantastic line or a set of lines. I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't read the exact, quote word for word. But the mom, right, the head of the family, the guy's like, look, I didn't do anything. He was in on it with me. You need to, you know, get him as well and try to get information from him. And she's like, people lie, but ashes don't. And so that's when you know, like, that's the holy S moment, right? You know that they're not only going to kill him, but they're going to process him into ash so they can get all the information, the true information out of him, right? And I think that's such a cool use of this as well, right? Now, obviously, like, this probably wouldn't work on, like, a legal system, right? Because you'd have to actually kill the person to make the ash. So if somebody's innocent, you couldn't really get the truth. But I love this idea, right? It's almost like that Minority Report thing, except with dead people's ashes. I just thought it was so cool. This book is just absolutely fantastic. I think each and every issue gets better and better and better. So definitely pick this one up. Bone Parish number 4 is a 5 out of 5. Back over to DC and another superhero book. We have Batman Secret Files 2018, I guess number 1. I don't know. It's also a one-shot. I wish they would do a series of these. I think the tech is fantastic. I think the Batman book is good. I used to hate it. Now it's good. But I really want – I would love like a third Batman book that kind of deals with these kind of stories, right? Like oh God, what was it, like Tales of the Dark Knight and those kind of books, Gotham Knights, Gotham Central, like Arkham Asylum, those kind of things where Batman is in the book, but it's not really the focus of the book. It's more about people and how they deal with Batman. I would love to see a book like that. So DC, if anybody over there listens, just please do that. I think that'd be fantastic. And there's definitely an audience for that. There's definitely an audience for that. For those of us that grew up in the, you know, 80s, 90s era, loved reading those books, there's your audience. And I mean, that's probably the majority of comic book readers anyway. All right, this one's done by a bunch of different people. I'm going to talk about a couple of the stories, not all of them. Real briefly, I want to touch upon the Tom King story. It's the one that opens up the book with gorgeous art by Mikael Janning, colors by Julia Belair, letters by Clayton Cowell. And this is an interesting one. It's got Superman in it, and Superman finds this platinum kryptonite that can give people superpowers and gives it to Bruce, and Bruce is unsure if he's worthy, and he asks Alfred, and then the story's over. It was an interesting choice to put in here. I'm not sure why it was in here. I think, to be honest, this was the weakest or close to one of the weakest ones in the book. And that was kind of upsetting because I think the progression that I've seen in Tom King and Batman has been so great, and I'm really enjoying the book quite a bit right now. But this kind of felt like a story from the beginning of the run, which is the run of the current series that I really hate. So I didn't enjoy it as much, but I liked some of the ideas, like this platinum kryptonite thing that can give human superpowers. I thought that was so cool. Why not run with that instead of going back to this emo Batman thing? But that was an interesting one. I think my favorite one on here is the second story, The Nature of Fear. It is written by Ram V, whom I talked about before. Savage Shores, for example, he's writing that. A book that I really love. I think Ram V is one of the up and coming writers. His indie stuff is really fantastic, and this might be the first stuff he's done for DC. I could be wrong, but really great stuff that he does, and it really shows in this particular story. So of course, because Jorge Fornes, the art, an artist whom I also love. Of course, if you are reading Hot Lunch Special over at Aftershock, same artist, so you'll be familiar with the art style. I love it. And it worked well there, and it works really well here. And, you know, going back to this the third Batman book that doesn't really focus on Batman, Jorge Fornes would be the perfect artist for it. Because, like, the environments, just the way he draws them is just incredible. The people themselves look so realistic. It's got kind of like a little bit of a Golden Age, Silver Age vibe, but definitely much more unique and detailed than that kind of artwork, right? Things were very simple back then. Comics now are very complicated, very complex art styles. And he's just so detailed. It's beautiful, beautiful work. Now, of course, you can assume that because the book is titled The Nature of Fear, it's a story about the Scarecrow, and you would be correct. Matt Wilson on colors, Steve Wan on letters. Sorry about that. And basically it deals with a cop, a GCPD cop, who encountered the Scarecrow, was shot with the toxin, and he has to go on this journey to try to get over the Scarecrow toxin, right? Nothing new there, but I love the way that it was done, right? Because Batman kind of plays second fiddle to this cop, even though Batman actually helps him guide out of this fear that he has, right? And I love the way it was done. It was, you know, artistically very creative as well, right? So you see Batman kind of become this bat monster thing, which we've seen before, but it works really well here. And I hadn't seen it in quite a while. We see kind of this cop, dealing with his fear, where he looks down a tunnel. And of course, at the end of the tunnel would be where he gets over the fear. And, you know, Batman tries to convince him, like, hey, this is how you fix it, right? Don't concentrate on your fear. That's how you make it worse, right? If you let the fear consume you, then you learn how to deal with it. And he just can't do that. So as we learn, he is sent to an insane asylum. And my assumption is that it's not Arkham. It's not explicitly stated, but, you know, it could be Arkham. I'm not sure. But he's in there. And of course, you know, Bruce is in there because he donates money to the hospital. And he sees the cop. He's like, isn't that the cop from last week? And the doctor's like, yeah, he can't get over his fear. The gas still has him. And, so we see that maybe the guy didn't really learn how to control his fear. And I thought that was so visceral, right, to like human nature, because, you know, it's very hard to get over your fear sometimes, you know. I thought about like stuff that I'm afraid of sometimes, and sometimes I don't think of anything, and all of a sudden like something might happen. I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I'm afraid of that. Sometimes I wonder if it's like fear or just like something I don't like, right? Like I don't feel like I'm afraid of spiders, but if I see like a gigantic spider, then maybe I'll be a little afraid, right? Like, you know, in my studio, it's off to the side of the garage. There's a room. And especially now that it's getting colder, you know, bugs try to come inside the house. And of course, they can't really get in the house, but they can get in the garage because, you know, they can just get in through the garage door. So sometimes I'll see some bugs in here. And, I think last week I had a brown recluse, and it was literally like a foot and a half from my foot. And, I kind of freaked out a little bit, right? Cause when I think about it, I don't think about it. Like it's just a spider, whatever. And my wife's got this weird thing where like we don't kill spiders in the house. We take them outside and you know, put them back in the woods. There's woods behind the house. And, so we don't kill spiders. But brown recluse, listen, I don't need my hand or my foot falling off. You know what I mean? So I killed it. I killed it. But when I saw it, I kind of jumped a little bit. Not like I didn't scream, but I was like, oh shit, a spider, big old spider. And, so yeah, so I had to kill it. Kind of sad, but I kind of get it. I kind of get it. Next story I want to talk about is called One. It's written by Cheryl Lynn Eaton with gorgeous, gorgeous artwork by Elena Casagrande, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Darren Bennett. And this kind of deals with kind of the how Batman would deal with the legacy of Bruce Wayne. And I thought that was really interesting, something that I don't think we've seen really touched upon in quite a long time in the Batman titles. But to me, it harkened back a little bit to movies like The Dark Knight and what's the one? Batman Returns or whatever. Not Batman Returns. That one's terrible. The Nolan ones, right? Basically, this one has Batman dealing with some of the crime-ridden areas of Gotham City that he maybe doesn't always go to. And the girl that he meets there confronts him about that. She's like, don't you belong in Midtown? What are you doing here in the hills? And basically what's going on is there's kind of a gang war, drug war going on. And the government may be involved, and they're using Wayne Tech to kind of get drugs to these drug dealers. And I thought that was really interesting because I was recently listening to a podcast about like the CIA and how they were involved in the drug trade in the 70s, you know, with the Iran-Contra gate and all that stuff. And fascinating stuff. So it was perfect timing for me. And it really rang true. But I love the way it was done because, you know, Bruce doesn't really know everything that goes on at Wayne Tech, right? At Wayne Enterprises. He's kind of the head, but you know, there's people there that are doing projects that maybe not everybody's aware of, but they're doing it for profit. And I thought it was a really fantastic story. Definitely kind of opportune with the times as well, I think. And just, I think, beautiful artwork as well. This was kind of a surprise for me. I wasn't expecting it, but I really, really enjoyed it as well. There's a few other stories as well that were good, but not as good as these two, I think. Overall, Batman Secret Files, I thought, was a worthy addition to my pull list last week. And kind of coming by surprise. I didn't realize it was coming out until like a week ago, maybe. And so I had to put it on my pull list real quick. But really, really solid. 4 out of 5 as well. Of course, it wouldn't be Halloween if we didn't talk about Witches, a book that hasn't been out in years. I don't know. When was the last issue of Witches? It's been a long time. Witches Bad Egg Halloween Special number 1. This, of course, same creative team, Snyder, Jock, Hollinsworth, and Robbins. And it is a brand new 80-page, by the way, standalone issue. It collects several stories that came out in Image Plus magazine, which I hadn't read. But I really enjoy it. It introduces a new character, Sebastian, a little 11-year-old boy who, through happenstance, finds out that he comes from a long line of witch hunters. And that kind of sets up the story. And really well done. I really missed Witches. And I got to say, the original Witches book, I think, was a little... It was tough to read at times. And I think, in many respects, I didn't know exactly what was going on for a good chunk of the book. But I think this one is a fantastic introduction to witches because it explains everything that you need to know. Not only that, I think it explains what the witches are better than the original Witches book did. basically we learn quite a bit about this, right? So the witches are kind of maybe an offshoot of humanity. They don't really know, but that's kind of maybe what they think. And, you know, they live in the woods. You know, when a witch is born, they live in burrows and they have to feed off of animals until they're old enough to feed on a human child, and then they can reach adulthood and then they can, you know, breed more witches or whatever. So basically we when the book opens up, we meet this kid Sebastian, and he just lives an ordinary life in this little ordinary small town, and supposedly he's going to be a giant part of the next arc of witches, which is scheduled for sometime in 2019. They didn't say exactly when, but Snyder had a nice recap at the beginning of the book. And, you know, he's like, I'm just ordinary, moved here from, I think, Akron, Ohio, or whatever it was. And, you know, just a normal childhood. And he's got a crappy teacher that he's running late to school, and he's going to get yelled at because she used to be a nun. And we all know how that is, right? Like, nuns, there's plenty of stories about nuns in Catholic schools, how terrible they are. So he's ready to go, and he tries to find a shortcut through the woods. And the guy pulls up in a van. He gets freaked out because we all know dudes in vans are scary, and it turns out to be his neighbor's dad, I think it is, so, some girl that he goes to school with. And he's like, oh yeah, I know you, like, I'll get in the van with you. Well, that's when he hears a little chitter-chitter that we know signifies a witch, if you read the original. If you hadn't, you very quickly learn. And basically this dad, you know, tries to help out the witches, and he's got a baby witch in the back of his van, and he's going to feed Sebastian to her. Fortunately, his mom's been following him, shoots the dude, kills the witch, and then has to kind of tell Sebastian who he is and what their family's about. So, we learn kind of a little bit about, the mom's backstory, his dad's backstory, who is dead, presumably maybe killed by the mom, but I don't think that's specified. It's kind of ambiguous. He may have just died during a witch raid. And, basically the story fast forward 6 months later, and he learns that he has to become friends with his neighbor, whose parents are helping grow a witch in a burrow in the woods, and they're going to feed a child within 6 months. And so, you know, he has to help, he has to become friends with the kid to gain intel on the parents, and then also find out whether the kid is in on it or if the kid is going to be fed to the witch. As it turns out, the parents have been doing this for a long time. They've lived for hundreds of years, and they have kids to get to a certain age so they can feed them to the witches that they grow. Because the witches, after they feed on a human, give them little, I think they call them tinctures. They're basically potions that can give you abilities. So either like, you know, immortality or riches or wealth or success, whatever. Whatever it is that you want, right? It's like making a deal with the devil. And so we kind of follow that story. And I thought it was really well done. There's some things that I was a little confused about. At one point, Sebastian and his friend go into the woods because the kid saw his parents go into the woods and go into this burrow, and he saw the creature. And so he wants to show Sebastian. And of course, Sebastian knows about it, but he hasn't told his friend that he knows. So they go out there, and he finally tells his friend that he knows. He believes him. They both get thrown in, and they're about to be fed on the witch. And, you know, Sebastian manages to kill the parents. They reveal in the process that there's somebody in the Irons that is kind of feeding him information. The Irons is the group that fights against witches procreating, and that's the group that him and his mom are part of. And the mom shows up pretending to be the person feeding them information. And they have this whole thing where, like, oh, you're working with the other side. And she's like, yeah, I hate you. Like, I never wanted to have you. Now I can work for the other side and whatever. I don't have to deal with you anymore. You're weak like your father. And the kid starts crying. Like, they start duking it out. He throws this rub on the mom that, he kind of concocted to kill the witch. And then she's like, oh yeah, I'm just kidding. That was a test. Like, I wanted to make sure that you were ready for this. I thought that whole scene was really odd the way it was done, but, interesting regardless. I hope when the book comes back, they'll deal a little bit more with that in that second arc of witches. Overall, I really enjoyed it though. Like I said, I think this may be the most explanatory version of witches I've ever seen. A book that I really loved, a book with fantastic art, but a book that really had me scratching my head a little bit when I read volume one. But this was really great. If you've never read it, start here and maybe go to the first volume or just wait till volume 2 comes out. But really good stuff. Again, it's 80 pages, so we're worth it, I think, for me. It's going to be a 4 out of 5. Final book of the week, pick of the week from Vertigo, Hexwives, #1. This is written by Ben Blacker with gorgeous art by Mirka Andolfo, colors by Marisa Luis, letters by Josh Reed, and a great, great cover by Catwoman's very own Joelle Jones. So this one's kind of billed as a supernatural Stepford Wives, and I definitely got that vibe once I got to the end of the book. But it doesn't start off that way. In fact, when I started reading it, I was like, was this solicited wrong? Because this is not the story that I'm reading. So I'll get to that in a few. Basically, we're taken on a journey through time. It begins in like the 1660s, I believe, with the Salem witch trials. So you have these men going after these witches who are obviously lesbians. Part of their magical abilities are gathered from their love for each other. They're extremely violent, in particular the head of this witch coven. And every generation she kills like the head of the family, right? The dad. And then we have another story set in like the 1700s. There's one like the Wild Wild West. And they're all really fantastic. And she is absolutely vicious, right? Vicious. And these guys really are kind of wanting to control these women because, well, for different reasons. #1, they're lesbians and, you know, they're very religious. They don't believe in that kind of stuff. They should believe in man and woman should be together. So that was interesting. But even through all that, there's a lot here about like female empowerment. And I thought that was really interesting. There's a book that I didn't talk about. I can't remember what it's called. Man, I should have wrote this down. But the new Max Visaggio book from Black Mask also deals with witches and has a similar tone in some ways. Definitely much more toned down than this one is. I thought that was a really interesting juxtaposition between the two in how they deal with these witch covens. But this one's just brilliant, and it's a freaking gore fest, right? So, you know, if you like that stuff, I thought it was brilliantly done. Brilliantly done. The art is beautiful, of course, but I think the story was really captivating, and I think each of these characters is really captivating. We end up fast-forwarding to present time, and we meet the current head of the family. It seems like, of course, times have changed, so now there's maybe an organization, a secret society that kind of follows these witches and wants to get rid of them. And the guy's like, listen, we've been doing this thing for hundreds of years. We always do it the same way, and it never works, right? Like, this woman killed my dad and his dad and his dad and his dad going back for hundreds of years. Why don't we try this new thing? And he's like, I have a secret weapon, and we don't see what the secret weapon is, but presumably it's a person. My assumption is maybe another witch. I'm sure we'll learn about that in future issues. And then we fast forward, and it's very Stepford Wives, right? Like, they're talking like they're straight out of the 50s, wearing clothes straight out of the 50s, talking about baking cookies and cakes for their husbands, and all their husbands work together, and they make jokes about like, oh, your husband never tells you things because you're so cute. You should just belong in the kitchen. And they're all like, ha ha ha. Yeah, I'm just baking cakes is the best thing ever. And they like hide cigarettes from each other and like they smoke a cigarette. And she's like, oh, I didn't smoke. Like we were hanging out and such was smoking. No, I didn't smoke, honey. Don't worry. Yes, of course I'll bake you a cake. Oh, I dropped this. I called you because I dropped the bottle and it broke. Oh, don't worry. I'm not going to cut myself with a glass. I'll be very careful. It was just fantastic, right? Because you can tell, and these are the same people, right? We meet all of them by name. There's like probably at half a dozen different women. We meet them all by name. And at first you're kind of taken aback because two are in a relationship together through the entirety of the book for hundreds of years. And then we see them in this Stepford Wives kind of place. And they're talking about each other's husbands. And I'm like, oh, that's okay. Now we're getting somewhere. And then kind of as the book ends, we see this guy who comes home. He's like, hey, honey, I'm home. And, now we need to see kind of how this whole thing happened, how they got these witches to kind of be hypnotized into this state of being. I thought this was, fantastic. I'm really liking these new Vertigo books, by the way. Vertigo, I think for a long time was kind of in the lulls, as they say. You know, when books like Clean Room and that batch of books came out, I think there was a lot of potential, but the books didn't sell very well. But I think the lineup that we have now, like Border Town and this one, for example, I think Vertigo is about to be on a hot streak again. And that's really exciting, for me. So Hexwives number one is going to be a 5 out of 5. All right. Let's talk about books coming out this new comic book day. I'm going to kick off from Dynamite, Battlestar Galactica Classic number one, written by John Jackson Miller, who's done work, Star Wars, Star Trek, and Halo, with art by Daniel HDR, who did Red Sonja, and awesome cover by Kelly Jones. Yes, that Kelly Jones. And, you know, Battlestar Galactica. So if you've never read it, then I'm not going to explain it to you. I love Battlestar Galactica. It's the best. I think I dig the new series the most. The one that came out in 04, 05, around that era. By the way, I just started rewatching that, so very excited for this. I love Battlestar Galactica, both iterations, the classic and the new one. And, you know, they've been doing this a bit lately. We just had a book that ended recently. I think David Byrne wrote it, as a matter of fact. It was the Battlestar Galactica Classic versus Battlestar Galactica. So, that was a cool series. Kind of weird to see the two timelines interact, but, cool. So I'm definitely looking forward to this one. I love the TV shows, and, I'm digging the comics as well. So we'll see how this one goes. I hope it's not just another retelling of the story, because I think if you're buying this book, you probably already know what that is, right? So anyways, looking forward to that one. That's from Dynamite. Over on, let's see, where do we want to go next? Let's go to Boom Studios. Cullen Bunn, Jesus Hervas, and Vanessa Del Rey. That's Empty Man number one. Not to be confused, but maybe you should be confused by The Empty Man. So this is a follow-up to The Empty Man, but just called Empty Man. And it follows, what happens to society after this really weird virus that turns people into killers comes about. And the virus is called The Empty Man virus. So this is a follow-up to that. I'm really looking forward to this one. Of course, I love Cullen Bunn's work. Maybe I'm a little jaded. Yes, he does podcasts for the network, but who cares? He's just a fantastic writer anyway. And, you know, horror is his thing, and I love Cullen Bunn's horror stuff. So I will definitely be picking up Empty Man number one from Boom Studios. Now, if I told you there was one writer that I love more than any other, sorry, Robert Venditti, it's not you. It is Grant Morrison, and of course this week is the launch of Green Lantern, or excuse me, The Green Lantern, number one. Grant Morrison with Liam Sharp, and I've been waiting for this for forever. I'm not a big fan of the A cover, but whatever. I don't think I'm going to get this in physical copies anyway. It's going to be a digital only. But I'm really excited for this one. I saw some preview art for it this past week. I think the book looks gorgeous. I think the direction that Grant Morrison is going to be taking this book in is going to be really interesting. And the first real change to Green Lantern since probably, like the Blackest Night stuff. And I've been reading Green Lantern for a long time. I love the Jeff Johns stuff. I love the stuff that Venditti's doing for years on the book, but it's nice to have a change, right? Cause even when we had New 52 and then, Rebirth and all that stuff, DC, what was it? DCU? Yeah, DCU. And then Rebirth, I think everybody changed except Green Lantern. That book kind of continued in the same direction. So that was an interesting choice. And now we're finally getting a change. So looking forward to this one. And of course, I love Grant Morrison. So there you go. Over at Image, Outer Darkness number one, John Layman with Afu Chan. And this is a sci-fi thriller mixed with horror in space. Mankind has colonized the galaxy, but during their travels, discover a terrifying secret in the outer darkness of space. Dun, dun, dun. Listen, everything's better in space. So, this is going to be awesome. I don't know. I like John Layman. We'll see how the art is. It's hit or miss for me on the Afu Chan art, but I do like John Layman, and I love horror and sci-fi. So mix them together and this could be pretty interesting. Again, that's Outer Darkness from Image Comics. What I'm really excited about is Road of the Dead, Highway to Hell number one, written by Jonathan Mayberry with art by Andrew Moss. And this is a prequel to Road of the Dead, a movie that's not out yet, but it is George Romero's final film in the Of the Dead series. So, of course, Night of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, Land of the Dead, What more? I mean, I'm missing some. I know I'm missing some. Anyways, this will be the final one. Of course, Romero died. So, matter of fact, I think Romero died like a week after this book was announced. This book was announced sometime over the summer. And, the movie, I think, is in production, but this kind of serves as a sequel to it. And I think it'll be an interesting one. It's, of course, a zombie thing, and I love zombies, but it mixes in some Mad Max elements with, like gang and turf wars as a result of this zombie apocalypse. And, you know, it's not necessarily anything new. There's a really great zombie flick. It's an Australian film called Wormwood. Interesting enough, it's, the full title is Wormwood, Road of the Dead. Not related to this. And it's very similar. It's a zombie apocalypse with, Mad Max elements to it. And this really weird sci-fi twist at the end that I loved. Check that out. I think it's on Netflix, by the way. So, Wormwood, Road of the Dead. Anyways, I'm looking forward to this one. I can't wait to see the film, but, I'll take the comic for now. And this will be a 3-issue miniseries, if I'm not mistaken. It's $4.99, but, if you're a zombie fan, then this will be right up your alley. And the final book is going to be Marvel Knights 20th Anniversary, number one, 6-issue miniseries. We've got Donnie Cates, great writer, Charles Foreman, fantastic artist, Jeff Shaw doing the cover. This kicks off this 20th anniversary Marvel Knights thing. I was hoping they would just kind of relaunch the line, but I think Punisher is really strong right now. You know, Daredevil's kind of winding down and then will return next year. So, we'll see how this one goes, but I'm excited to check it out. I love Donnie Cates, so, definitely looking forward to this one, and I hope it means a kind of a resurgence of these characters within the Marvel universe. That is going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you all for listening. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email me yell@comictalk.today. I'll be back on Wednesday talking about Dark Horse Comics because they've sold part of the company and I want to talk about this. Very interesting. I'll catch you then.